This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. North Carolina entrepreneur Josh Whitten was a businessman from an early age. When he was about five, he used to go tadpole hunting, and he'd sell his bounty to his neighborhood pals, the very same pals who helped him catch them in the first place. Clearly, Josh had some natural talent for business. But it wasn't until years later that he turned his talent into a career. After graduating from NC State, he started Transloc. It's a software that tracks city buses in real time. So now, if you've ever waited for a bus and it seems like it's never going to come, Josh's technology can help you. You can use your smartphone or computer to look up a map and see exactly how long you have to wait. But Josh didn't stop there. He's also started an urban farm and a company that spreads the gospel of the electric car. In his free time, he likes to dabble in psychology and philosophy and calls himself an explorer of the psyche. We have him in the studio today to see if we can probe the mind of Josh Whitten. Josh, welcome to the program. Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Tell us a little bit about Transloc. What is it? What does it do?
So the mission of Transloc is to just make mass transit easier to use. Everybody who, the people who ride the bus, largely are the people who have to ride the bus right now. And so what do we do to get people riding mass transit who have the choice of a nice, comfortable automobile instead? And for them, you need to make it more reliable, more convenient, less of a blind faith leap that when they walk out to that stop that this thing is actually going to come. It's very comforting and encouraging if you can look on your phone or on a map and see that this bus really is making its way toward you and it's going to come down the street. And so why don't you give this a try?
How did you come to the idea?
Well, graduation was looming back in college, and I was committed to being an entrepreneur at this point. I knew that I wasn't really cut out to work in anybody else's companies but my own. And so I had for many years kept a long list of innovations that I thought the world could benefit from. And so as graduation approached, I was working on three different ideas with several friends, trying to see which one would pan out to be a career.
What were those other ideas?
The other one had to do with systematically silencing mobile phones. 6 years ago, or seven now, it was pretty obvious that the mobile phone was becoming the primary contact device, and people were pretty poor at the time of turning them off and putting them on silent. And so I was trying to find maybe a way to systematically do that, so when people walked into a theater, they would automatically go onto silent. And it just turned out to be a good idea, but a bad one for me to get in on. It all involved these carriers and wireless companies, and there was no room for a little player like me. The other one had to do with a small sort of niche software for managing university housing. We're just looking around. You know, when you look for an idea, it's good to look close and good to look at environments you have experience with. And this thing, you know, throughout, you know, judging all these ideas, I'd find myself continually standing at the bus stop. Sometimes the bus would actually never come because I was pretty poor with my calendar. And sometimes I woke up on a holiday and stood outside there for the bus to come and suddenly realized it was a ghost town and I should, you know, be home visiting my parents or something. So.
And that is the worst feeling at the bus stop, isn't it? Is the fact that you might be at the wrong stop. It just truly, it might not come.
Absolutely. And sometimes it doesn't come. There's a detour, or even if it is coming, psychologically, when you're waiting, especially by yourself, 5 minutes feels like 10 minutes and so on.
And what you do then, it's the actual transit company that buys the software, and then I'll have an app on my iPhone, and then I'll access that.
Correct. So the transit agencies are very interested in getting more riders and keeping the riders and keeping the riders happy and lowering complaints. And so the software helps get them riders and get them happier riders so that, you know, the what they used to aim for was just having perfect on-time performance. And that's become so impossible that we're saying, well, maybe we can't always be on time, but we can always give the riders so much information that they can just roll with the punches. So.
Transparency. That's the answer.
So
who's using it now?
Oh, wow. So there's probably around 34 institutions around the country, a number of cities, and especially universities. It turns out universities became one of the major adopters of our technology because when you look at their rider, you have a very wired demographic. You have the most wired transit rider in the nation. And so a lot of the Ivy League schools, Harvard, Yale, big cities like Gainesville, locally NC State here. And also Transloc is about to release technology in partnership with Triangle Transit that's going to unify all of our major transit systems here in the Triangle. So instead of having to go to one website to check out Chapel Hill Transit and one site to check out CAT, you'll be able to go to gotriangle.org and see all the vehicles from all these agencies together in real time, see where they connect and things like that. It's nothing like this ever been done before, actually. And so we're about to get some technology here in the in our region that's first of its kind in the industry.
Well, that'll be cool. So unified regional system, at least for locating and scheduling. Now if we could actually have a system that all works together and gets us from one place to another, how great would that be?
Right, right. So this is a first step.
First step. So let's take us back to those roots of your entrepreneurship. I need to hear more about the tadpole caper.
Yeah, so I found myself just starting companies. I didn't have any entrepreneurial role models at all in the little Polish town with an Indian name, North Tonawanda, New York. There was no entrepreneurial role models, but I found myself drawn to doing that sort of thing anyway. Whether it was selling these tadpoles to the neighborhood children, you know, I'd charge more if they had legs because that meant that they were probably going to survive. And I would charge more if you wanted rainwater instead of tap water because it was, you know, free of the chlorine. This is about 5 or 6 years old. And so.
Some of them were actually helping you catch the tadpoles?
I don't know how, you know, just a certain persuasiveness or confidence, but I would sell these to the very children who had helped me in the first place catch these things. So I can't say it was the best way of doing business, but I was certainly taking I was pushing the boundaries and taking my mind out for a spin there.
Now, I grew up in that very same part of the world that you're talking about, I just wonder, and I used to catch tadpoles, probably not far from where you were in North Tonawanda.
Competition is what you were.
And it never occurred to me that we would eat them. No, but did you ever sell? Because that was a highly industrial area. Lots of Dow Chemical was up there, Carborundum. So did you get more for tadpoles that had 9 and 10 legs or anything?
No. that usually meant they were going to die pretty soon. Yeah. There were deformities of all kinds because they did find out that it was a toxic waste site that we were playing on eventually. Yeah. But the deformities, unfortunately, were usually a lot less spectacular and a lot more grotesque.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you did it occur to you at the time that this was quite a feat that you're selling something to?
No, not at all. This seemed like the most natural thing in the world. And when I went off to middle school, I would stop at the dollar store and buy, you know, lot of bubble gum for very, very cheap, and then I would sell it during class to children who were just bored and desperate for some kind of distraction. So I'd, you know, sell gum for 50 cents a piece that cost me, you know, 3 cents a piece. And so it just seemed like the most natural thing in the world to me to observe these opportunities. I didn't get an allowance, and so to observe these opportunities to make money. And sadly, that entrepreneurial drive was totally squashed by the school as I went to.
You didn't do well in school academically.
No. I was put into school early because I showed kind of exceptional academic promise. And shortly after getting to school, at least the schools I was involved in, I found out that they really had almost nothing to do with learning at all, no matter how the teachers and the school system carried on, that it was really just a sort of popularity contest that I failed every day. I mean, what really mattered is whether you were very attractive or could throw a football. And I'd been put into school early, and so I was always smaller, and I had terrible acne and glasses, and I was just – I failed the popularity contest. And under the constant ridicule, believe it or not, it was hard to actually study or learn. So I just mostly put my head down on my desk for the next 10 years, and the school system considered me a complete dummy.
There's a big reward for being popular, of course, and not being popular can be a pressure. There is some kind of reward for academic excellence, but it's a pretty narrow kind. I mean, it's the sort that isn't going to notice your entrepreneurship. You're going to be punished for selling gum.
Yeah, it's whatever reward is there can be eclipsed by total social rejection. For one, very few children have the you know, internal fortitude to say, well, I don't need friends and I don't need to be liked. All that matters is this information that I'm learning. And secondly, the reward that appeals to me most is that the information is useful. And you can imagine that so often what children are learning, it just has no real relevance to the challenges they're facing. And so I, you know, during the summers, my parents, in order to keep my mind from totally atrophying, they'd ask me to read in a scientific encyclopedia set they'd bought me for a half hour, just, you know, start with A, go through B, and so on, and then to journal for 15 minutes before I went outside to play. And that right there, I think, probably provided for more education than I gained in years and years of schooling.
But what were your teachers and parents saying? I mean, obviously they'd recognize something. You get in this accelerated program, and then it's not panning out. What's the diagnosis from their point of view?
So many teachers are too busy to really go home and dwell on just what's going on with this one kid, or just they're so busy trying to maintain behavior in the classroom that it's hard to, you know, psychoanalyze me. I'd say out of the 10 years of the dark ages of schooling that I was in, there were two teachers who picked up on what was going on, and only two. One teacher, Mr. Thomas or Mr. Thompson, something like that, in high school. One day he came to me. I'd been put in the class with the worst kids, juvenile delinquents, and after a while he said to me, "Look, here's a copy of Orwell's 1984. Just read it. Let me know what you think once in a while, and you don't have to come to class. You don't have to do any of this stuff here." You know. So he was the only one who saw what was really going on, and unfortunately the rest of the teachers were too busy to really notice that.
On the State of Things today, we are talking with Josh Whitten, entrepreneur, philosopher, explorer of the psyche. We're going to talk more about some of his innovations, some of his ideas, and how he thinks about thinking just ahead on the State of Things. A Brush with Nihilism, A Descent into Depression, and How That Worked Itself Out on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with entrepreneur Josh Whitten. During his life, he has created quite a few businesses, including the current project Transloke, a company that tracks city buses in real time. We're talking about the hard time you had in school. By the time you got to college, what did you think you were going to do?
By the time I got to college, I had abandon any concepts of entrepreneurship, because those ideas weren't nurtured in my education or in my life. I really didn't even know there was such a thing as entrepreneur. So I started off with natural entrepreneurial tendencies that then just entirely disappeared. And I thought I'd be all kinds of things. I thought I'd be a scientist or an engineer or a psychologist or a theologian or what. I just many occupations. And it wasn't until probably my junior year, after realizing that I'd become dissatisfied with every job I'd ever had after about 3 or 6 months, that I began to encounter entrepreneurs on campus who were being brought in to speak on the business side of campus. I was in the computer science.
Went to NC State.
At NC State. There were a few professors who, it's very popular now, but who were doing this weird thing by bringing in these entrepreneurs. And when I would just hear them speak, we just have an affinity and our personalities would click, and I understood what kind of animal I really was finally.
So then you did that. Now, what were you doing in those last couple of years? Were you just sort of waiting to get out, or were you trying to apply any of those courses to what you would hope
well,
for your business?
Both. I was you know, practically had to strap me to my seat to keep me in there. I couldn't wait to get out. The idea that kept coming to me when somebody would, you know, when a teacher would assign homework was, you know, you damn well know the answer to this problem. I need to go solve a problem that people haven't solved yet. That's all I could think of. You know, I just felt like it was kind of beneath me to keep being handed exercises.
That's the worst question in the world, isn't it? Don't you hate the question when the teacher asks a question, they know the answer, and say, raise a hand and say, no, no, and you look around the room and you think, well, you really aren't looking for me to explore this question. There's only one right answer.
Sure,
so, you know, it's there's no wrong answer.
Yeah. So I couldn't wait to get out, and so I tried to make the best of. I was committed to getting my degree, though, because I realized that with no track record in entrepreneurship, people weren't going to take me seriously. I needed some kind of credibility. So let's get this. Let's get a degree. Let's make sure we have some letters there. And I did my best, though, to wrangle the curriculum into being something that would support my entrepreneurship. So I had a few electives that I hadn't spent on tennis or bowling yet or something silly. And so I found some business classes in entrepreneurship and took those, and also did a 3-hour independent study during which I could just research whatever I wanted. And that was glorious. And so I went back and I said, could I do a 6-hour independent study? And they said, well, you'd have to get approval from all these people. I said, let's do it. You know, so I went around collecting signatures and had 6 hours of independent study. And I was so by the end of my last semester, 9 out of 12 hours were entirely supportive of what I was doing. But so I had to really finagle it.
What were you looking into?
Well, I took one class on the finance of startups. And so the teacher said, you know, come up with a sort of fake idea, and we'll run the numbers on it during this course. Well, I didn't have a fake idea; I had a real idea, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I got to use that course to sort of do, you know, new venture planning, I think it was called.
But you lied and said it was a fake idea.
No, well, you know, I actually
it's not a real. Idea,
I was very suspicious that people were going to run with my idea and steal it. Later on, you find out that actually doing something about any of these ideas is so difficult that you can talk at a regular volume and your idea is not going to be stolen by the person at the next coffee table.
Through all of this, you had a psychological crisis that was making it very difficult for you to get through school, right?
Yeah. So the period between being a sophomore and a junior, I fell into a rather deep depression where I had come to the philosophical conclusion that life was indeed meaningless, that it was arbitrary, that there was no real point to it. And I let that philosophy of meaninglessness really, really sort of course through my body, where it acted like a poison and left me sort of depressed. And there's a number of ways. And I had a semester thrown out of college, actually. So really kind of very grateful to the university for seeing that something had happened to this, you know, bright, eager young student that suddenly straight F's, you know. And so they actually, there's a giant gap in my transcript where they just threw out the semester after I went to the psychologist. But, a lot of my friends were depressed, especially the smartest ones or the most intellectual ones, I would say. And so eventually they all kept telling me, look, we're on medication. You need medication too. It's just what happens to people like us. Let, you know, go to the psychiatrist, the school psychologist rather. And I went. And sure enough, he thought I was very depressed. He at first thought I maybe just needed a different career. And so he gave me a list of occupations to choose from, a survey of 100 different careers. And I rated them all at zero, including his own. And he thought, gee, you are depressed. And so he sent me off to a psychiatrist who could prescribe the medication. And the psychiatrist asked me what was wrong. And I told him my story of the meaninglessness of it all. And I'm trying to find some, you know, reason to do anything these days. And he looked at me and he said, so you want me to give you medication because you're an intellectual? That's what he said. And it was really flattering, but I took me a minute to get what he was getting at. And he said, you're engaged in a process and the medication will only slow it down. And the thought that I was engaged in some kind of process was not an idea that had been suggested to me. It's very sad and scary that of all the people who knew of my depression, nobody said, you know, you might be engaged in a process that you're working through.
No, well, nobody says that, do you think, because the process, that point in the process is sad, uncomfortable, unpleasant, and we don't like those things. We want a pill to make all that go away.
Yeah, it is unpleasant in everything you said, but there's just a complete ignorance about what this might be a sign of or of how the mind works. And so, yeah, we're afflicted by some sort of unpleasantness and we think that we've been, you know, we've contracted a cold or a flu or something like that and we just need some medication to make it go away. So I spent a long time after I came out of this depression really parsing what had gone on there. And one way to parse it was, the first way I parsed it was that, you know, one day I had after meeting with the psychiatrist and going home and really sort of being optimistic that I might be engaged in some kind of process. I was paying close attention to my mind at this point. And one day I was assailed by the thought, man shall not live by bread alone, which was an old, you know, Bible verse, of course, that meant very little to me these days. And the more I thought about what it was getting at, I came to the conclusion that it was lobbying for the need for some semblance of spirituality, that bread alone meant this sort of arbitrary materialist existence, and that I really needed, there was something else that was needed in the human diet in order for me to live. So that was the first way I parsed it. And later on, I would encounter Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning, where, you know, he said that, you know, meaning was a necessary ingredient in human life. Well, I had no meaning in my life. And so I was responding in a perfectly normal, healthy manner, given a mind that had jettisoned meaning as a possibility. So this depression is exactly how I ought to have responded to the ideas that I had embraced. And the thought that depression could be brought on by a changing worldview or beliefs or thoughts, no one had ever suggested that to me. And so that's something that needs to be more commonly understood.
That this is a signal. It's part of a process that is leading to something good, and this is a little a kind of suffering that has to happen along the way.
Yes, that there's something that needs to be resolved, and this is a natural response, right. And this is the right and good response. So, a third way to think about this came to me much later through the psychologist Carl Jung, who said that the question to ask yourself in such a state of depression is, why has my unconscious withdrawn its support? Its support from my life. And, you know, you think of what the unconscious is, this huge part of the mind that, you know, you look at the brain scans and a very small amount of the brain is actually engaged in conscious activity at any given moment. So what is this unconscious doing? Well, this unconscious is having thoughts and it has beliefs and it has emotions that it floats up to you and you get to enjoy. And so in this case, my unconscious had completely withdrawn its support from my life. It was no longer going to send up any feelings of joy or pleasure while I was holding on to this belief of meaninglessness. And it was sort of a standoff, as Jung would put it, between my conscious and my unconscious mind. And thankfully so, because my life was heading down a very dangerous path of lethargy and decay. And thank goodness that my unconscious wasn't willing to float up all sorts of pleasant feelings along the way. I would have just kept on going on a disastrous path.
And when you use that term standoff, it contains within it all of the danger that a standoff is. Mm. Here is your unconscious life, the fullness of your life, saying you're headed for disaster and the only way I can get your attention is to put you in a mood that could ultimately kill you or snap you out of it. And that's my bet.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, what Carl Jung spent his entire life sort of lobbying for was the idea that you weren't alone in your mind. There was another intelligence there who was, whatever you were consciously seeking, your unconscious, there was a force down there that cared about your self-actualization or your individuation and your growth and the full expression of your personality throughout your lifetime. So it wants to, much like a plant, it wants to unfold and unfurl and bear fruit at some point. And your conscious attitude can become a hindrance. You know, the plant never says to itself, you know, I'm not buying into this whole sunlight and water thing. I don't think I want anything to do with it. Yeah. But our conscious mind can do the equivalent, and then the standoff will form.
And it is interesting, as you say, a very tiny fraction of mental activity is what we call consciousness, the stuff that allows us to speak and think and analyze. And most of the activity is it actually the brain talking to itself. Mm-hmm. It's the internal conversation that goes on. What is this it? I mean, it almost sounds a little spooky and spiritual. Is it some other entity? I mean, how do you take it? What do you perceive it as?
It sounds very spooky and spiritual. And I'm actually glad for that aspect of it because it's scientific and experiential and practical and spiritual all the same time. And life is very spooky, you know, or it ought to be. I think the proper stance toward it would be to feel that awe and mystery. You know, like I have this website where I write all kinds of thoughts that I think are interesting. And for example, we all have this concept of ghosts, even though very few people have ever seen a ghost, if anyone, you know, it's debatable. And yet we all have a concept of what a ghost is or what a ghost would be. We all sort of intimately, you know, kind of understand what a ghost would be. And I think to myself, well, maybe it's because, you know, we're wondering, we're looking for ghosts out there, but really if you look just about an inch behind your eyes and up a little bit, you've got this force inside of your skull that wakes up every day and wants your body to move and animate, and that force will go away one day and your body will fall lifelessly to the ground. So I think life is spooky, and Jung says that the mind is the crossroads of matter and spirit, and so I think it's really this intersection or this crossroads that is a mysterious place that I'd like to explore more.
Have we climbed too far out on this rational branch, given it too much credit, so that when we hear things like that, we think, I can't accept that. I can't even begin to think about my life and my mind that way because it's not rational.
Absolutely. I think rationality is one aspect of the psyche, one strength, one mechanism, and it's not the whole story, though. And the reason we have sort of a lopsided appreciation for it is because it happens to be where we most commonly experience ourselves as existing. So when I feel like I'm talking or I'm thinking, I sort of experience myself surrounded by this rationality. But then we have times in some of the best times, where the rationality is sort of stops being front and center and you allow yourself to experience what they would, you know, call presence or being, or you just watch the sun rise and you feel like you're connected to the whole universe suddenly. And that, there's nothing rational about that, and thankfully so.
Well, and the other part of that is the willingness to go through the pain and the agony of this journey when it calls you into depression and says, I don't want to subdue or mute those symptoms, I want to know what those symptoms are telling me about mm-hmm. who I am meant to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the great spiritual teachers, it seems to me, and I wonder how you feel about this. I mean, if you look at Gautama of Siddhartha or Jesus of Nazareth, these are two men who had to give up one life and follow another. Right? One was a prince and he went off to be mm-hmm. a teacher. Another mm-hmm. one went to the cross and clearly from many of the stories wasn't really looking to do that. It was a hard decision to make.
Right.
These are people who went through that journey and came out the other side. Then you get the sort of mystical stuff about whether they lived after death or rose from the dead. But that's that in the context that you're talking about, it actually is. It does make sense.
Yeah, I look at a lot of those spiritual figures and people, including Gandhi and Thoreau. Thoreau had his transcendentalists, and they spent time, you know, trying to consult this inner voice. And Christians, you know, we're going to talk about the still small voice or the moving of the Holy Spirit or wherever you look. You know, there's a reason Gandhi is getting up at 5 a.m. and being quiet for an hour before he goes and faces the day. Wherever you look, this thing is really a pervasive reality. And just because there aren't commercials, you know, on television for it doesn't mean it's not, it doesn't exist.
It's the last thing the commercials want to get us. Exactly. We start thinking about that. We don't have to buy half of the stuff that they're pushing. Gandhi's very important to you in the way he began to notice the way his thought worked and pay attention to those ideas that passed through his mind.
Gandhi is important to me for so many reasons, and I know he was a very, you know, flawed individual as well, and he was actually the first to admit it. There are so many acts of humility on his part where people wanted to make him into something more than he was, and he would just bring up some point of incredible failure on his part and simultaneously make them in awe of his humility and realize that he's just human. So it was, you know, kind of damned if he was, damned if he didn't. You know, people elevated Gandhi to godlike status. But the way he was... very sort of anti-authoritarian. He grew up in a very authoritarian religious culture. He found his own way. With Gandhi and Thoreau both, what appeals to me most about them is that they had an independent intellect. And this was the power to be surrounded by hundreds, if not thousands, of people who wanted you to do one thing and to do what you felt was right anyway. And that's a power that very few people have. And so I've also thought a lot about, well, if Gandhi keeps claiming he's just a regular person, how does a person end up like Gandhi? And there is a way, and it's a terrifying possibility. We actually comfort ourselves by making these exceptional people into exceptions, and then we don't hold ourselves to any sort of standard like that. And so from what I can tell, you know, we've talked about the psyche and all these voices that go on in the unconscious. Well, one of them is what people would commonly call the conscience. So if at any moment I say, you know, Frank, what should you really be doing, or what are you avoiding that you ought to be doing? It won't take but a second for you to be flooded with thoughts about, oh, this broken relationship or that shady thing you once did. And, you know, the conscience is waiting for you to follow at any time. And it's so unpleasant. We don't want anything to do with it. And so Gandhi did the opposite, and he decided in his quest for meaning that he was going to make the conscience the loudest voice in his head. He was going to make it unbearably loud, and he was going to follow it every time it asked something of him. And the thing about the conscience, you know, we have this phrase, follow the conscience. Well, it tends to lead somewhere. You know, you keep doing this following. You know, you follow it a little bit, and guess what? It's going to make you follow it some more. And so if you make a habit of doing that, I think you end up with a life like Gandhi's. And it's a terrifying possibility because it means it's open to all of us.
Does this help you as an entrepreneur or hinder?
It slows me down from heading in one direction too confidently. Entrepreneurship is definitely a way that I can sort of reach a compromise in the world of being myself and participating in society. It allows for elements that are very natural to me, more natural than working in someone else's large company, for sure. And yet there's a certain unphilosophical tendency in entrepreneurship to just head very quickly in a certain direction with all the power and efficacy you can and not really question, is this the right direction to be heading in? Gandhi has these ideas that are very averse to or conflict with a lot of the concepts in business. And I do like to distinguish business from entrepreneurship or innovation mm-hmm. from business and entrepreneurship. I have one essay on my website that says called Business Disinterest, where I talk about that I'm not really a businessman, but I'm an innovator, and you just kind of fall into business. But I mean, like Gandhi's idea of non-possession, that you know, he was meditating on some scripture in the Gita, very similar to one in the Bible about how you ought to ought to own nothing, and how was he to do this? And was he to get rid of his books and his houses and just have, you know, just his loincloth, or was he to get rid of that? And what about his body? You know, did he own his body? And one day he realized that it wasn't that he was supposed to get rid of these things, but that his attitude toward them was to be one of the steward, that these were things that he did not own, but things that he was in control of for a little while. And because he was in control of them, he had a responsibility, you know, while not owning them, to see that the right thing was done with them. And so it's very interesting to see what you'll do with your resources when you consider them your own versus when you consider them to be something that's just in your care for a little while.
On the State of Things today, talking with Josh Whitten, CEO of Transloke, and electric vehicle experience as well. We'll talk a little bit more about that, co-founder of the Raleigh City Farm. Part of that conversation coming up when our chat with Josh Whitten continues on the State of Things. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour with Josh Whitten, CEO of Transloke and the electric vehicle experience. He is the co-founder of the Raleigh City Farm. Let's talk about those things. First of all, the electric vehicle experience, Tesla Roadster, something you're very interested in. Tell us how the business works.
Sure. Like Thoreau, I'm a fan of simplicity, and so I have this love of electric cars. They have up to 85% fewer parts than a gasoline engine vehicle. Or maybe it's because I just don't know much about regular cars, and I think if we turn them into sort of computers with wheels that I could really work on my car more often or something like that. But one day, I got to drive one of these fancy cars, the Tesla Roadster, and it was the most exhilarating driving experience of my life, just aware that the electric motor accelerates because there's no delay, you know, and it's just such a immediate torque. And I got out of that thing, and I thought, well, geez, you know, electric cars are in the news all the time, and there's so much media hype about them, and almost no one has ever driven one. And of course, my sort of opportunity sense started tingling, and so I thought, well, what if we allow people to just rent, you know, to rent these for a short amount of time? So it's not about getting from A to B like your traditional rental company. It's kind of about getting from A back to A in one of these cool cars. And the idea there being that if more people have experience with electric vehicles, then you may not decide to go out and buy a $110,000 Tesla Roadster, but your opinion of electric vehicle technology has now been elevated quite a bit because you've just had the most exhilarating driving experience of your life at the hands of this technology. And so maybe you'll get out of your car and you'll say, well, you know, I was kind of thinking of getting a new car just because I was, you know, kind of getting antsy with this one, but it works and it runs. And, you know, I think I'll just drive this one for two more years. And when the electrics come down in price, then I'll jump in. So I think we can really change people's perceptions through the electric vehicle experience, EVXP.
And how's it going?
It's going pretty well. We've started just a few months ago and had a handful of rentals, and we're finding there are a lot of organizations out there that are actually trying to champion electric vehicle technology. And once again, when they hold their meetings and they bring people in, what do they have for them? They have slides and charts about oil and electricity and solar and all this sort of stuff. And people are kind of nodding off. And you know, but what if they could actually hop in the car and get a taste of all this stuff they're talking about? So that's turning out to be one of our customers.
What are some of the other challenges, do you think? I mean, do you think mostly that's it? If we stop thinking of it as a golf cart, we'll maybe actually get out and buy one? Or what else is going on?
There are real technological limitations to the electric vehicle right now. And so I'm not saying that, you know, if you don't go out and buy one, then you're just not, you know, helping things and saving the planet and all that. They don't make sense for a lot of people right now. But there are always in any market those people who are willing to adapt their lifestyle to the technology instead for the sake of some value like simplicity, you know. So it's going to take me 2 days, you know, I'm going to stay in a motel to drive, you know, 500 miles with my electric car, but I'm going to, it's a fun experience, and I'm just going to change my lifestyle and my expectations of where I go. And so to at least get those people essentially donating their dollars to the further development of this technology, that's the way that all technologies come down in price. You know, the people telling me the electric cars aren't going to happen because they cost so much, and I think, well, what if we'd said that about computers in the 60s? You know, this thing costs $800,000 and takes up, you know, the whole room. Like, these are never going to catch on.
Right. Well, we actually got an email from somebody when they found out you were going to be on the show, and they wanted to ask, wouldn't it be a great idea if we had solar-powered carports that would plug in to electric vehicles?
Solar-powered carports, yeah. Sure, it would be. And there are some people working on that. I think the way it works is that it really doesn't matter where the solar panel actually is, because when that car is not there, you don't want the solar energy necessarily going into some battery anyway. You just want it plugged into the electrical grid. Right. And so it's more of a marketing and mental association to have the solar panel near the electric car than it is an effectiveness kind of thing. But we need all the help we can get at this point. So
And it does sound like the infrastructure is part of it. If we could just pull in and plug in and it was all solar and that was how our lives were working, it would be a lot easier than having to design and build in more infrastructure to support your car.
Right. Well, and there's so many ways to generate power. There's new ones being proposed all the time. And so I think if we just standardize the infrastructure under the hood to be electric, then we can build all kinds of different power plants and work on upgrading those forever and ever and ever without having to gut the innards of these cars every time we come up with a new fuel.
And you can pay $500 for the upgrade, which is how software companies work.
Correct.
Let me ask you about the urban farm you started in Raleigh. What was that all about?
Yeah, it's still in the process of being started, and there's a team of us working in Raleigh to start what we're calling Raleigh City Farm, where we're just going to demonstrate that you can grow a whole lot of food right here in the city and compost our waste. And again, this is a sort of challenge to our lifestyles today. You know, the notion that probably 80% of what goes in people's home trash doesn't need to be going there, that you could, you know, create a compost pile. And compost itself is a technology that's incredibly underutilized and overlooked because it won't play your you know, MP3s or you know, doesn't play video games or make any cool sounds. It's just like this pile of dirt, right? But it is actually one of the most underappreciated world-changing technologies in existence that hasn't actually been adopted by the world at large. It kind of was overlooked. And so, you know, I consider it even a spiritual practice to tend to one's own waste so that you take these things that previously you considered waste and you would hand to somebody else to go putrefy in a landfill. And instead, you take it outside and you get this mixture, right, of carbon to nitrogen. And in 3 months' time, you're looking at jet black, really sort of nice, aromatic, you know, smelling, nourishing soil that we could be growing our food in. And the sad fact is that most of our food isn't grown in this nourishing, healthy soil that could be made from our waste. It's grown from, you know, petroleum pesticides and natural gas fertilizers and trucked from very far away. And people are looking – we know that people – every one of us is looking for some kind of connection with nature and has a deficit there. And so we go to the park or whatever, you know. But we could be growing a little bit of our own food as well, and we get that connection with nature, and you'd get, you know, free produce besides, and you'd get you know we talk about the mind and all its complexity. Well, part of your mind is very unsatisfied sitting at your desk looking into a glowing rectangle all day. It actually wants to have its hands in the soil. And so for your overall sense of well-being to be out there turning the soil and planting the seed and watching it grow, it's healthy psychologically. It's healthy for the body. I think people could be so many of the modern diseases would go away if we were growing a little bit of our own food right in our own backyards and bringing some in, just for the micronutrients that are present there. And whenever I talk about growing food, though, people say, well, I can't quit my job and grow food. Right. And that's not at all what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is that if you've never grown food before, find a little, you know, 4-square-foot patch of nothing in your backyard and just make a bed of salad greens there. And you'd be amazed at how much food you can grow intensely in such a small amount of land. It wouldn't take you more than a half hour a week.
Well, it is going to take some kind of time, though. And it's going to take me a little time to grow it. I've got to put the compost in the bin. I've got to turn it. I've got to move it over to the garden, grow mm-hmm. And then I have to cook that food. I can't mm-hmm. just stick it in the microwave.
Absolutely. It takes doing. And so the question I ask is, what else are you going to do? You know, we have all these efficiencies so that apparently we can watch television. You know, the at the top of the pyramid here, when we have all of our gimmicks and efficiencies and time saving and outsourcing done, we now can do nothing. And is that really what we're after in life here? And I know that I'm not after doing nothing, but I'm after having the full human experience. And I had a friend over one night and we got a bottle of wine and took an iPod out and two shovels and we turned the compost and had a great conversation. It was far more satisfying than having gone to a noisy bar and shouted at each other to try to commune.
When people have this experience, they come to that conclusion. When they don't, or maybe if they don't have it often enough, they don't. How is it that what is so obvious that we have extra time now, that because of these devices and efficiencies, we've got it and we're sort of squandering it, and it's not making us happy.
Right.
A lot of folks are doing all sorts of things to self-medicate, whether it's through entertainment or through chemicals. Clearly, we are not happy. And yet, if you were to suggest make your own compost, get an electric car, slow down and pay attention to your conscience, that's the last thing I'd want to do.
Yeah, it's the overwhelming power of what is normal and what is the status quo. And there's this unspoken implication of what it means to be successful that you can actually, I like going to different cities and feeling what that message is. So if you're floating around, you know, like Cambridge, Massachusetts, the idea is you better be packing some mind-blowing ideas to rattle off at the bar. You're not a real person. And I just got back from Silicon Valley, and it's, you know, do you have a startup company and or have you exited one? And but then there's one that sort of there are a number of messages that are just pervasive through all the Western culture, and there's a sort of frantic busyness and mixed with a bunch of lethargy, and also just people are sort of resigned to live lives where they're not really doing jobs that really resonate with who they are as a person. And you know, there's so many other ways to live that we don't notice. And that's why I come back to this independent intellect as being one of the most valuable of qualities, because it allows you to just see right through all of that.
Is it something that we are losing entirely almost as a species? Could it be bred out of us at a certain point, this kind of independence, this sense of dissatisfaction with what's right, even if we can't quite figure out how to throw off the spell?
I don't know if long term it could be bred out of us. What I think we can tell is from the trajectory of the universe so far is that would be a tragedy. So far, the universe has been heading in a direction of increasing complexity and increasing awareness. And you know, we are the most thoughtful matter that has ever existed on the planet so far. You know, you and I could talk about what is right to eat. You know, how should we raise and treat animals? Well, this is very new in the scene of the world. You know, animals just used to chase each other through the jungle and see if they could fit each other into their mouths. And here we are, the most thoughtful matter that's ever existed, wondering about the way that we're living. And so, I think it's clear to me that the universe is trying to head in this direction of greater thoughtfulness, and I think we're just at a period now where we're adjusting and coping with our newfound discoveries and powers.
What about business? You talked earlier about coming to this conclusion, one that Gandhi did, that we're stewards of the material universe, and that changes everything. I don't have to give up stuff and live in a cave. I just change my attitude and relationship to matter and to money and wealth.
You could have an empire so long as you're managing it as a steward. There's nothing, you know, yeah.
Is there anything that you look in terms of the evolution of business? I mean, we're really sort of at this threshold now. Mm-hmm. We've really got a business community that can now increase its productivity, increase its wealth for ever fewer people, and impoverish ever more. Mm-hmm. The unemployment rate just went up even as profits continued to soar. That's a business model that's very attractive to at least 1% of the population that has almost most of our wealth. For the 99% that don't enjoy all that wealth, they seem to be perfectly happy to let that go on. Is that business model in the ascendancy? And is there this conscientious business model that allows us to succeed, allows us to be comfortable, allows us to own things that doesn't mean it only goes to 1% of the population, or is it locked out forever? That possibility.
So I don't think that there's a difference between wealth and money, and there's really an unlimited amount of wealth waiting to be created. So, and that's something that people don't learn about in school either. That, you know, wealth is really unlimited, and you can have almost nothing. You can go get a book from the library on how to fix a Honda, and you can go borrow some tools from somebody, and you can go to a junkyard, and you can take $200 cars, and with your knowledge and time, turn them into $1,000 car, and you've just generated wealth, and you haven't picked anybody's pocket or extorted anybody, and it's a powerful and beautiful process, and so there are many, many, many opportunities for people to generate wealth. But it has been trained out of us. It's been trained out of us. I wouldn't say it's been bred out of us. Back to the unconscious. I think there's a part down in the unconscious that's never buying into these ideas of subservience. But consciously, and again, why people are depressed and unhappy. The unconscious is not content with this lifestyle of being a cog. But so there are opportunities to create wealth, and you know, one of that are waiting for anybody, so long as they could have that imagination and creativity and curiosity sparked again in their own minds. one of Gandhi's favorite quotes was from Thoreau, who said, one of the best thoughts is the ability of mankind to elevate itself through a conscious endeavor. So I sometimes toy with the idea that we'll one day look at people who have billions of dollars, who have lived in a very narrow way and cut themselves off from the human experience, as somebody you just feel sorry for because they've just sort of maybe had their priorities out of order and they've missed out on a lot of good stuff. So first of all, that we'd stop elevating them as really having something that you really want and that you'd be better off with. And there is a movement in the entrepreneurial community and among young people at large that I notice where it's not enough to wave a bunch of money in front of them and say you could make $1 million if you did this. They ask where's the meaning or where's the mission? You know, what are we doing? I know I can make $1 million. And we have a lot of people, especially children growing up in affluent homes, who they sort of arrived before they ever lifted a finger. And so they don't just want more material prosperity. It doesn't mean anything to them. They want meaning.
And is there anything to be gained or when we look at workplaces in the commons, seeing the commons work itself into the business community, open source software companies, this sort of thing? I mean, is that some kind of a model or is that just an aberration in this?
No, open source is a beautiful model. Social entrepreneurship is a new beautiful model. The triple bottom line is a new beautiful model that we can conceive of starting successful companies that don't turn much of a profit, but that sustain their own economic viability. But what they're actually after are the second and third bottom line of ecological and social mm-hmm. impact. So it's kind of a new thing for people to go around and we even have this concept even in Silicon Valley now. You'll see investors who have made tons and tons of money in the traditional venture capital model, and now they're doing what's called impact investing, where you know they're looking down at infinity now and saying, "Did I actually make the world a better place?" Mm. And now they're going to start backing companies who the real payoff is going to be in benefiting the world. And so we're starting to see a lot more of that.
Josh, thanks so much for spending your time with us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Josh Whitten. He is the CEO of Transloke and the Electric Vehicle Experience, also co-founder of the Raleigh City Farm. You can learn more about him and find links to his business at joshwhitten.com, Whitten spelled W-H-I-T-O-N. Thank you for listening. If you have a comment about the show or want to hear an archived edition of a past program, you can go to stateofthings.org. You can also check us out on Facebook for a calendar of events. Program produced by Alex Granados and Amber Nimix with help from Isaac Davey Aronson. Anna Cassell is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.